Electricity, a big idea that's inspired countless new ones. From powering the light bulb to virtually powering our entire lives. 30 years ago, State Street launched the Spider S&P 500 ETF, SPY. A big idea that inspired the world to invest differently. And still does. What can you do with SPY?
Before investing, consider the fund's investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses. Visit SSGA.com for a prospectus containing this and other information. Read it carefully before investing. SPY is subject to risks similar to those of stocks. All ETFs are subject to risk, including possible loss of principal. Alps Distributors, Inc. Distributor.
You're listening to The Exchange. Here's today's show.
Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to The Exchange. I'm Tyler Matheson. Here's what's ahead. Busy hour ahead. Wall Street building on a record-setting run. Our market guest says it doesn't matter when the Fed cuts, that run will continue. He's here with what makes him so bullish. Plus, we are awaiting Reddit's first trade, minutes from now, probably. Bullpen Capital's Duncan Davidson told us yesterday if it prices at the top of the range, it could be setting up for failure. Well, it did price at the top of that range, $34. Duncan is back with us. It's indicated now to open between $49.50 and $50.50 right now in just seconds. We will see what happens when that first trade crosses the tape. And two reasons why Netflix will continue to dominate the streaming wars. Our analysts will tell us what they are and how much upside he sees ahead. But we begin with Julia Boorstin, who is live at the New York Stock Exchange awaiting Reddit's first trade. Hi, Julia.
Yes, the first trade is expected any minute now. Snoo, which is the Reddit character, was just moved past behind me, and the trade is expected to open between $49.50 and $50.50. That at the midpoint would be a 50% premium over the offering price of $34. It did price at the upper end of the range. We see a lot of excitement for Snoo over there, along with Steve Huffman, the CEO of Reddit, who we interviewed earlier today. So now we're just awaiting the first trade, but it does feel like we're getting close. Tyler.
But we haven't seen this kind of frenzy or excitement in a long time. Maybe if Reddit comes out of the box strong and holds its first day gains, this will encourage other companies to come forward. Right, Julia?
Yeah, look, there is a lot of hope that the IPO market will start to open up. There was just an IPO yesterday that traded up over 70%. So the question is, how many IPOs here that have that kind of upside will really encourage other companies to start to go public? And the numbers that we saw back in 2020, 2021.
Julia, you holler when the action comes. We'll be back with you in just seconds. Meantime, let's bring in Duncan Davidson to talk, excuse me, a little bit more about Reddit and the overall IPO market that may ensue after this Reddit debut. He was with us yesterday and said, among other things, if the stock priced at the high end of its range, which it did, that might take a little wind out of the sails on the open, I suppose, was your argument. Explain your argument and explain what you're seeing right now.
Well, normally I want to see these things price about 20-25% higher when they open, which indicates a really good spread, but not crazy. This is doing much better, so I share everybody's excitement. What I'm worried about is that it might show some volatility as a lot of the pump and dumpers on the Reddit side, you know, the Wall Street Bets people, jump in then jump right out again. So I'm going to watch today volatility. But regardless, this is a decent opening. If it does open here, which should spur other people to start joining the party.
Yeah, so where would you expect, you know, the history of IPOs is a checkered one, frankly. Many, many, many of them do not trade at their opening price in 6 months hence. What do you think might happen here with this one?
Either it becomes a stonk, which means a meme stock, which the retail traders go crazy on and it flies high. Or if it starts getting a lot of institutional holdings, which I hope it does, I would buy into this thing about 6 months out because there's a huge overhang of private investors who will probably get out of the lockup and take their profits. So I basically would look at this thing as a long-term hold, but wait 6 months before jumping into the party.
Very interesting. Duncan, we're going to come back to you when this stock opens for trading. If you would indulge us by hanging on for just a minute, we're going to turn now to Dom Chu for a market update. Hey, Dom.
All right. So, Tyler, I mean, it's record highs across the board here for the Dow, the S&P 500, and the NASDAQ Composite has now joined that record high party. The Dow Industrial is up 320 points, 0.75%. The S&P 500 is at 52.54 right now, up 29 points, about 0.5% gains. The NASDAQ Composite up 0.75% to 16,483. And it's been an up day the entire day so far. We were up 37 points at the high for the S&P, up 23 at the lows. One stock that is not participating in that record high run is Apple, after the Department of Justice unveiled antitrust suit issues against the company there. The shares are down 3.5% right now. So the Dow component and the S&P 500 component and NASDAQ component, heavily weighted in two of those indices, is down big on that news. But check out some of the other stocks that are perhaps in the ecosystem that are benefiting from some of that stuff. We know that the Department of Justice is going to focus on things like Apple's dominance in smartphones, cloud gaming, smartwatches, that sort of thing. Well, check out payment stocks like PayPal Holdings Block catching a bid partly because of those issues around Apple Pay. Garmin on the wearable side up about 1% right now, and Take-Two Interactive, Electronic Arts, Tyler, both publishers of online or mobile games that are seeing at least some benefit, at least from the trader perspective, on some of the Apple antitrust stuff. So keep an eye on those stocks in the ecosystem. Ty, I'll send things back over to you.
All right, Dom, thank you very much. Meantime, the Fed and the markets are aligned on 3 rate cuts, it would seem, for this year. But our next guest thinks there will be one more. He sees a total of 425 basis point or quarter point cuts starting in June. And he says the difference between the Fed and his call comes down to one data point. We'll find out what it is in just a moment from Morgan Stanley's chief global economist, Seth Carpenter, along with CNBC's senior economics reporter, Steve Leisman. Carpenter and Leisman, you've been injured in a Fed crack up. See the law firm of Leisman and Carpenter. Steve, why don't you put yesterday's activity into context for us? Any sort of day later ruminations on your part?
You know, I think this is reminding me a little bit of the December meeting where the market's going a little bit far on not very much based upon what Powell said yesterday. Yeah, the 3 rate cuts survived the projections, but, you know, very slimly, Tyler. It was one vote essentially away from being down to 2. And look, the market could be right here, and Seth Carpenter, who I'm going to hear from in a second, could well be right here about his inflation outlook, but I still think there's some risk. If we don't get a better report, a better inflation report in the March data that we'll get in April, then I think there's going to be some backtracking of the optimism that's out there right now. That's my take. I'm sorry to be a little curmudgeonly on this fabulous day of a new IPO and the market having so much fun after the Fed. But remember, the market had to do some... The bond market has been backtracking from December. I do think there's another discussion to have, Tyler, and I'll let Seth speak, which is that the stock market seems somewhat disconnected from what the Fed had been doing before.
Seth, why don't you react to what Steve just said? And I guess my question for you is, you're holding to the idea maybe of 3, maybe even 4 rate cuts between now and year end. If inflation continues at its current sort of trajectory level, which is a little hotter than expected, and in light of the fact that the Fed boosted its GDP numbers, that would argue, wouldn't it, for maybe a slower rate cutting regime rather than a more accelerated one?
Great question. And I have to say, it's great to be on with Steve. He gets to make me look like the cheerful one, which is perfect from my perspective. We are looking for 4 cuts this year. We're looking for the first cut to happen in June, which, again, is consistent with markets. I suspect is actually consistent with what the median person on the Fed was writing down as well. June is what? 2.5. The June meeting is about 2.5 months away, maybe a little bit more. Go back in time to where we were 2.5 months ago, and the market was pricing in so many more cuts. So I don't know that you want to put too much stock right now on where the market is. And then even the Fed, we go back to last March, they misjudged where they were going to end up the year. They revised their own forecast up 2 times from the March meeting and then back down again one more time to where they end up at the end of the year. So forecasting this far out is tough. What makes us at 4 instead of 3 instead of at 2? June seems like the right time. The economy was stronger, as you said, but Powell, I think, correctly noted that a chunk of that is stronger supply side, more jobs, more immigration, more labor force. And so they seem comfortable cutting in June even before inflation gets all the way down. And then for us, our forecast for the second half of the year is faster disinflation than what I infer the market is thinking, faster disinflation than what the Fed has written down. But that's a second half of the year phenomenon, and things have to come true for that to be realized.
I think I heard, Steve, correct me if I mischaracterize your comments, the idea that maybe the stock market, the equity market, has gotten a little ahead of itself with respect to where the Fed is. Did I characterize you right there, Steve?
Yeah, it's a bit like asking a guy two things. You know, what's your success rate with the operation, and what's your essentially the complication rate? They're two different things. I think if Seth has a positive or a better inflation forecast than either the market or one that is better than the Fed, that's one to go with. That's fine. But there's a risk around that forecast, and that's more what I'm talking about. I don't have a forecast, but maybe I have, Tyler, an appreciation for the risk around that forecast not being right. I just wouldn't be all chips in on inflation coming down. We've had two bad months. I can explain January pretty well. Having a little trouble, Tyler, explaining February as a kind of more of an anomaly. I think there may be a certain stubbornness. I hope I'm wrong in March. I really hope Seth is right. I don't want to be on the negative side of this trade, but I just want to say there's risk around the forecast here. I think Seth knows that and appreciates that.
Seth, why don't you address that point and answer the sort of root question there, which is whether the market equities have gotten ahead of where the Fed is forecasting.
Yeah, Steve could not be more right. There are clearly risks here. There's the old saying that forecasting is hard, especially about the future. And if you said to me, am I 100% convicted that inflation is coming down as much as our forecast? The answer has to be no. So I think Steve is completely spot on there. I will say, however, that there is an extra nuance here for equity markets. We are in an interesting, to say the least, cycle. And, you know, if the market wants to be positive because rates are coming down, that makes a lot of sense, the normal relationship between interest rates and the equity market. But one reason why Fed funds rates might not come down as much as we think could just be fundamentally stronger real side economic activity, which by itself should also be good for equity prices. And so I think we need to think about all sorts of different risks. Steve's 100% right. I think right now the equity market is looking at so many different components. What's going on with inflation and what does that mean for rents, for interest rates, but also what's going on with growth and earnings and what does that mean for rates?
Let me conclude.
And one more thing,
go
Seth.
Ahead, sir.
Just one more thing, which is productivity. I mean, that's where if I'm too curmudgeonly, it's because I'll be proven wrong, especially, I think, by the productivity numbers. Tyler, we've had three amazing quarters of productivity. It could just be all noise. It could be the beginning of something wonderful.
All right. We're going to wrap it there. Gentlemen, thanks very much. Seth Carpenter, Steve Leisman, appreciate your comments. All right. Stocks are continuing to build on yesterday's rally. And our next guest says the Fed doesn't need really to start cutting rates this summer or even this fall to keep the rally going. Joining us now, Andres Garcia Amaya, Zoe Financial CEO. Andres, welcome. Good to see you again.
Yeah.
It's been quite a while since we've been under the same roof, probably pre-pandemic. So explain your thesis here, and that is that the Fed doesn't really need to cut rates. The market can continue to make progress even if it doesn't.
Yeah, that's a perfect segue from the prior conversation, because the missing component here is earnings have improved significantly. Now, that comes along with a better economy, and obviously the Fed revised GDP upwards this year. But ultimately, we might find ourselves the next January with all-time highs and the Fed didn't cut at all, right? And the reason is, if the Fed didn't cut because the economy continues to do well and earnings continue to deliver, I think that's where equities are going to be focused on, rather than just being fixated on where interest rates are.
Do equity investors like the idea, or can they live with the idea that, okay, the Fed doesn't really need to cut so long as they don't take cuts off the table? In other words, it's the anticipation of a potential cut that is maybe even more important than the cut itself.
100%. I think that if each time they're reminding us we're data dependent, wink, wink, at some point we will cut, that might be enough if the reason that they're not cutting is that the economy continues to do well. Different story if they totally pivot to we need to hike. That's, okay, different conversation, right? But the December pivot towards, okay, no more hikes, but we'll see where we cut. Wink, wink, it probably will be soon. Mm-hmm. I think that's enough for the markets to focus on earnings. So if earnings continue to deliver, the market could go up.
Take us through those earnings and what your forecasts are for profits this year.
Yeah, I think consensus so far has pretty much gotten it right in the sense of improvement in operational leverage. We talked about productivity.
Yep.
Especially in the technology sector, right? That's like the true AI play.
How much is AI going to affect productivity and how quickly?
It's a great question, because these things take decades to play out for the whole economy. But it happens to be that the driver of stock performance has been technology stocks. And technology stocks are using AI, right? Especially large cap companies are using AI today, right? So from that perspective, I think there is some, usually this thing's a little bit fluffy. I think this time around, it is productivity that's coming from these stocks that are driving the market. And that could continue for a while.
That could continue for a while. How quickly do you see the adoption of AI tools and the benefits in terms of productivity for the non-technology right. companies, the industrials, the cyclicals, et cetera?
I think that's going to take...
Insurance companies, banks.
That's going to take a long time. Now, when I say a long time, it means maybe it's not a decade, right? Remember, even intern in their late 90s, everyone said, tomorrow, the intern... No, it took 15 years, 20 years for it to play out. It might not take that long. Things move a lot quicker now. But it is going to take a couple years for us to see Caterpillar and, you know, GE using AI the same way that Facebook does.
Andres, we have just heard that Reddit has opened. That's excitement in our book. We're going to leave it here. Thanks so much. Good to see you,
Thanks
sir.
Thanks for having me.
Let's go to Julia Boorstin now on the floor of the New York Stock Exchange. Julia.
Okay, so Reddit has just opened at $47. That was a premium to a serious premium to where it had originally priced at $34, around 38% upside. We're now watching the stock. It's up to ring the bell here with Lynn Martin, the CEO of the New York Stock Exchange. We're going to try to get over to Lynn Martin to get a sense of how meaningful this is for opening up the IPO market. But for now, we see the stock trading higher now of about $49. Back over to you.
All right, Julia, exciting moment there. $49 now. Let's bring in Duncan Davidson to talk a little bit more. Welcome back. What do you make of a move at 47, an open at 47, and a trade now at 49?
Well, as I said, I like it better when these stocks are priced 20-25% above the price. They open 20-25% above the price. 38 isn't so bad. The fact it's trading up is a very good signal, because often people take their profits off the top, the thing fades, and you got to get people to buy back in later. This is really good. We'll see where it ends up. I do expect it to be fairly volatile today. I've been glancing at the Wall Street Bet site. I mean, you'd imagine the Reddit community would support Reddit. Very negative sentiment there. But this morning, the sentiment has shifted to people talking about going in. So we're going to see whether they go in and then flip it or hold on to the stock.
Why do you think the Reddit community is down on Reddit?
I think it's because of who they are. In other words, if they can't drive it in a pump and dump thing, they're not quite as excited by it. But there are very smart people in that particular thread, that community, who I like to listen to. I don't know specifically who they are, but I listen to their analysis. And they like this company. I mean, they think this has probably got 2X in it, baked into it, or at least in the near term.
The moving up from the initial price there, now first trade was 47, now we're in the 50s on this. You mentioned a moment ago, Duncan, that you would like to see the participation of large institutional investors more than individual investors. Explain that a little bit.
Well, they're the ones who will hold it. Mm-hmm. The retail investor, particularly the Wall Street Bets people, go in and out, go in and out. They try to clip their profits. They run their little schemes, et cetera. I would rather see this held. I think Reddit's a long-term hold, as I've said. It may have a problem when it gets to the lockup in 6 months. But after that, I think this thing has got some good upside to it. They're on track to fix their profitability. They're still growing. They should do over $1 billion of revenue next year. So other than short-term volatility, I like this company.
Always great to hear from you, Duncan. Appreciate it very much. We're going to leave it there and go back to Julia Boorstin on the floor of the New York Stock Exchange with the president of the NYSE. Julia.
That's right, Tyler. I'm joined now by Lynn Martin, the president of the New York Stock Exchange. Thanks so much for joining us. Lynn, what does this mean? We see the stocks now trading at about $53.50. Yep. What does this mean for the IPO market in general?
I mean, I think the IPO markets are open. This is a great example of a company that has spent a couple of years focusing on their business, refining their strategy, and they are getting a warm welcome by the public markets today. It's great.
And do you have a sense of listings picking up? I know things are a lot slower than they were back in, say, 2021. What's your expectation for the next 6 months?
Yeah, you know, we have a lot of companies that we're working with to get out in the second quarter, so we're really optimistic. Today was a big test, though, of Can a company go public? Will the market embrace them? And it's a big day for Reddit's community, in fact. So thrilled for them.
Yeah, such a big moment for that community, which bought 8% of the shares of the float.
Yeah.
Were you at all concerned that the fact that they didn't have any lockup period would mean that they might sell today and create more volatility?
No, I didn't really have a view. I was impressed with the way the company has really focused on their community and embracing their community through this whole process. At the end of the day, it's a free market, and freedom of speech is something that Reddit celebrates every single day.
Well, we now see the stock is up over, is at $55, way up from that offering price of $34. Lynn Martin, thanks so much for joining us here with Reddit's IPO, and we have Snoo, the mascot, right behind you. Thanks so much. Guys, back over to you.
All right. Thank you very much, Julia. That stock up in the $56 neighborhood at its peak, now in the 55. That's about a 65% gain from the opening price, or the price from last evening of $34. Opening price was about 47. Huge beat, meantime, on the sales of existing homes in February. Diana Olick has the details. Hi, Di.
Hey, Ty. Yeah, and the stocks are reacting. The home builder ETF ITB on pace for its third straight daily gain, briefly hitting a fresh intraday all-time high back to its inception in 2006. And of course, all because existing home sales surged 9.5% in February from January. Sales still down 3.3% year over year, but that is the largest monthly gain since February of last year. Sales surged the most in the West and South. Northeast was unchanged, though. The realtors point to increased supply for the gain. Inventory rose over 10% year over year to the highest level since 2020, but it's still at a low 2.9-month supply at the current sales pace. And that, of course, pushed the median price up 5.7% from the year before to $384,500, which is the eighth straight month of annual gains and yet another all-time high for February. 20% of homes sold over list price. Now, important to note, these sales are based on closings, so the contracts were likely signed in December and January when the 30-year fixed rate dropped to the mid-6% range. It is now over 7%. First-time buyers did not surge with overall sales, just 26% of buyers in February, and that's down from 28% in January. 40% is the historical norm for first-timers. The realtor said consumers are now used to this new normal in mortgage rates, but now that we're back over 7% again, we got to see how the spring keeps going, Tyler.
Come back to those overall numbers on sales, if you would, and untangle it a little bit for me. Are we looking at a year-over-year gain in sales or not?
No, 9.5% monthly gain, which was much more. The street was expecting a 1% drop. So it was this big jump from January to February, but still down 3.3% year over year from February.
Well, that's what's interesting to me. In other words, you get a sequential month to month gain that is very big off of a low point in January closings. That would have been contracts sold usually in November, I suppose. But when you look at the year over year numbers, a decline, how healthy does that mean the housing market is, even though prices were up, I think I heard you say?
Right. Well, prices are up, but it's all about affordability because mortgage rates are currently higher than they were a year ago. Not by a lot, but they are higher. And also the inventory problem is still a problem, but we are seeing more inventory come onto the market. So that's why they're accounting for this month-to-month gain, because in the winter months we saw more come on, and we are now continuing to see more inventory come onto the market. So while buyers are still struggling, sellers are finally breaking out of that, I'm not going to sell because I have this very long, low mortgage rate. They're getting used to the fact that this is where rates are going to be. And if they want to move, this is just what they're going to have to do and get rid of maybe that 3% rate that they have now.
All right, Di, thanks very much. Diana Olick, appreciate it. All right, coming up, the Department of Justice going after Apple, saying it has a monopoly over the phone market. We'll look at the fallout if they can prove their case, the feds, that is. And what do we mean for Apple's ecosystem? Before we head to the break, let's take another look at shares of Reddit. Opened at 47, priced at 34, now at 53, up nearly 60% on the day so far. The exchange is back after this.
This is The Exchange on CNBC.
Hi, I'm Ben. I suffer from a condition called writer's block. It strikes when I'm at work. That's why I choose Canva Magic Write. It works fast generating texts in seconds, thanks to AI.
Common side effects include increased productivity, compliments from coworkers, feelings of satisfaction.
Now I can say bye-bye to writer's block.
Ask your boss if Canva Magic Write is right for you at canva.com, designed for work.
Canva. What's on the horizon for financial markets? At PGIM, it's a question that over 1,400 investment professionals relentlessly research in pursuit of your long-term goals. Specialized across asset classes, but united in collaboration, our teams provide global and local expertise. Our investments shape tomorrow, today. Pursue your tomorrow with PGIM, a leading global asset manager.
Welcome back to The Exchange, everybody. Apple shares worst day since August after the Justice Department announced a new antitrust suit against the iPhone maker. For more on the next steps and what's inside those allegations, let's bring in Eamon Javers from Washington. Hi, Eamon.
Hey there, Tyler. Well, speaking of those Apple shares, I just got off the phone with Department of Justice officials on a background briefing, and I asked them about the sell-off that we're seeing now in Apple shares, and I asked them what their message is right now to shareholders who are seeing value being erased today. And what a DOJ official said is, look, we are a law enforcement agency. That's how we have to make these decisions. In the long term, competition actually benefits companies, and we're not out to get anyone. We don't have an axe to grind. So that's their message to shareholders as we see those Apple shares dropping today. So let's reset where we are today. The Justice Department, along with 16 state and district attorneys general, have sued Apple for monopolization or attempted monopolization of smartphone markets. It's a civil antitrust lawsuit filed in the United States District Court for the District of New Jersey, and it alleges Apple illegally maintains a monopoly over smartphones by selectively imposing contractual restrictions on and withholding critical access points from developers. The Department of Justice alleges that Apple has broken the law, specifically Section 2 of the Sherman Antitrust Act, in five specific ways. Here they are. First, blocking innovative super apps. They're saying Apple has disrupted the growth of apps with broader functionality than what's on the iPhone now. Second, suppressing mobile cloud streaming services. They say Apple blocked the development of these streaming apps and services that would allow consumers to enjoy high-quality video games and other cloud-based applications without having to pay for the expensive smartphone. Third, excluding cross-platform messaging apps. They're saying that Apple has made quality of cross-platform messaging worse, less innovative, and less secure for users so that customers do have to keep buying these iPhones. Fourth, diminishing the functionality of non-Apple smartwatches. Apple has limited, they say, the functionality of third-party smartwatches so that users who purchase the Apple Watch face substantial out-of-pocket costs if they do not keep buying the phones. And number five is limiting third-party digital wallets. They say Apple's preventing third-party apps from offering tap-to-pay functionality, inhibiting the creation of cross-platform third-party digital wallets. Apple responding to these charges, saying, this lawsuit is wrong on the facts and the law, and we will vigorously defend against it. The court process is expected to take months, if not years, Tyler. And there's a political overlay to all of this. If President Biden loses to Donald Trump in the fall, it's a Trump Justice Department that could be in charge of handling the end game of this case, not a Biden Justice Department. Not at all clear how that would play out, but we should note that Trump DOJ investigators were the ones who began this investigation back before the Biden administration. So this might span two, maybe three administrations at some point. Back over to you.
Off the top of your head, Eamon, and forgive me if you don't know the number. I know that the technology is an area of interest for you, but not your specific beat. What is the market share of the Apple iPhone in the United States and globally?
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't have that figure right in front of me, Tyler. But what they're alleging at the DOJ is that it's not just the phone itself. It's the app store that's really part of the key issue here, in that they're throttling the development of apps that could themselves rise to become Apple competitors or challenge Apple's pricing power. And also that they're charging developers of apps too much money. Their fees are simply too high, and the costs then passed on to consumers for the apps are too high because of the exclusivity that they have with that app store. Between Google and Apple, the app store's there. That's pretty much the whole market, and they're saying basically what you've got is a duopoly with Apple in huge control over every other company in the economy trying to get access to customers through their app store. that's unfair power. And they say Apple's abusing it. Apple, of course, says, hey, wait a second, we're not abusing it. We're just good at what we do.
AJ in our control room says that Apple has 64% of the 64. Cell phone market, handset market in the United States. That's high in the U.S. I think it's probably lower globally. Nevertheless, this is a U.S. case. Eamon, thank you very much. Eamon Javers.
You bet.
Let's go to Bertha Coombs now for a CNBC News update. Hey, Bertha.
Hey, Tyler. House Speaker Mike Johnson tells CNBC he plans to invite Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to speak to Congress about the war against Hamas in Gaza. Comes after Netanyahu spoke with Senate Republicans at a luncheon yesterday. Well, Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer rejected a request for a meeting with Senate Democrats. The United Nations General Assembly approved its first resolution on artificial intelligence this afternoon. The United States-sponsored measure applies the UN Charter to AI development and will try to ensure developing nations can take advantage of AI's benefits, including detecting diseases and predicting floods. Newark Air Traffic Control is being relocated to Philadelphia as the FAA tries to address staffing issues and congestion in the busy New York tri-state area. The changeover will happen in June in time for the summer travel season. It comes as the FAA tries to address a shortfall of 2,500 air traffic controllers that has resulted in mandatory overtime and six-day work weeks for many controllers. They're hoping that they'll avoid what we saw last June, having gotten caught up in that when you just saw massive delays, particularly out of Newark.
All right. Thanks very much, Bertha Coombs. Coming up, sporting goods retailer Academy Sports and Outdoors having its worst day in nearly 2 years after an earnings miss and issuing lower than expected full year guidance today. We'll be joined by the CEO to talk about what's behind that weakness next. And before we head to a break, let's take another look at Reddit shares. They opened at $47, priced at $34, popped as much as 70% in early trading, up nearly 60%, a little more than that right now at $54.64. First social media IPO since Pinterest in 2019. The exchange is back after this.
Welcome to the Canva guided meditation for stress at work. Impending deadline? Generate Canva presentations in seconds.
So fast.
Brainstorm got too big? Ooh. Summarize with AI in a click. Writer's block? Release with Canva Magic Write.
Magical.
Stress less and save time at canva.com. Designed for work.
Welcome back to The Exchange, everybody. Shares of Academy Sports and Outdoors falling after missing on both the top and bottom lines for the fourth quarter. Full year guidance also came in a little bit weaker than expected. On the earnings call, the company said it is navigating through a choppy macroeconomic backdrop while putting in place the building blocks for its future. Those were the words from Steve Lawrence, CEO of Academy Sports and Outdoors. Mr. Lawrence, welcome. Good to have you with us. Happy you could join us.
Good to see you again.
Let's talk a little bit about your forecast, which I think may be what is causing the stock to stumble a little bit today. You've been working through a choppy macroeconomic backdrop. Explain why that is when a lot of the measures of the economic landscape are pretty positive right now, except for inflation, I suppose, which is sticky.
Yeah, I think if you go back and look at retail performance in Q4 this year, I think a lot of retailers saw a choppy environment. Customers under pressure, credit card debts at a pretty high level right now. Inflation's still pretty high. So I think the combination of those two has made the consumer a little more cautious. We're happy with our results in Q4 in terms of improving. But we see the customer still being under pressure, and we think that's going to continue at least into the first quarter of this year.
And so you brought down your estimates below where the FactSet forecasts are. Is that a case of wanting to underpromise and then overdeliver, or is it a reflection of what you see in the business environment, or a little bit of both?
I think it's a little bit of both. I mean, I think obviously one of our goals is to give the best guidance we can give out there in terms of accuracy, and that's what we tried to do. I think it accounts for kind of a continuation on the low end of the current trends we're seeing, but certainly implies that we could see the business inflect more positively as we progress through the year, and that's what we really tried to indicate in our guidance.
Are there particular categories of sales within your enterprise that are weaker than others? And if so, what would your hypothesis be behind why that is?
Well, we've seen some increases in some of the categories that have been lags for us, like our outdoor area. That business was certainly good for Q4. Where we continue to see some weakness are in some of these long lead time replacement cycle businesses, like fitness equipment is one. You know, obviously, if you bought a treadmill during the pandemic, you probably don't need to buy another treadmill, and that continues to be a bit of a soft spot. So those are some of the softer categories for us.
That's an interesting point. I mean, that might be a residue or a hangover from the, as you say, the pandemic, when people rushed out, they came in, they bought the fitness equipment, whatever it is, the home gym stuff, and now they just don't need to replace it. Interesting point. So let's talk about store openings over the next couple of years. You have a rather aggressive rollout here. Will most of those stores be in your traditional sort of regional footprint or geographic footprint, I should say, or will you be expanding that geographical footprint out of your traditional in the South areas?
It's a really good question. So we updated our new store guidance. Previously, we'd guided 120 to 140 new stores over the next 5 years. We've increased that to 160 to 180. We're looking at a better balance going forward. So about half of those will open up within our existing footprint. We have high brand awareness. Half will be in new markets. One of the things is we've opened up about 23 stores over the past couple of years. We found that when we go into new markets, if we can have more density as we go into a new market, that's going to help. So you'll see us cluster more stores as we enter new markets. So it's more of a refinement of the strategy that we rolled out about a year ago. Versus a wholesale change, but more stores, better balance across the geography, and maybe some more mid-sized markets we're going to look at as well.
Where would the new markets be? And I welcome you to come to New Jersey. We'd love to see you come up here because we need a little competition. And so my question then is, where are the new markets, and will you in those new markets be competing directly with Dick's, which is large, big here in the Northeast, for example?
Yeah, so we kind of see it as an expansion from our current footprint. So we're not going to jump wholesale to the Northeast. It's more of an expansion from our existing base, more stores in Virginia, West Virginia, and the contiguous states. Mm-hmm. So it'll probably be a couple of years before you get up into your neck of the woods. But certainly as we expand, you know, we bounce up against a lot of competitors, Dick's being one with the largest footprint, and as well as some smaller regional guys. But, you know, we feel like our value proposition and our position as the value leader in our space really positions us well to compete as we go into new markets.
Mr. Lawrence, thank you very much for being with us today. Continued success to you.
Thank you. Appreciate the
we
time.
Appreciate it. Steve Lawrence of Academy Sports. Coming up, you think high yield bonds mean high risk? Not necessarily, according to B of A Securities, with tax-adjusted muni bond yields nearing their highest level since 2017. We'll tell you where the opportunities are next. A little fixed income. Welcome back to The Exchange. It is March, so it is time to focus on your tax bracket. Brackets. That's the other kind of brackets that are all important this month. Our next guest has tax-free opportunities that he says are even more attractive now that the Fed has pushed out interest rate cuts. Joining us for the latest edition of Muni Money is Jared Woodard. He is the head of the Research Investment Committee at B of A Securities. Thank you, Jared, for joining us today. Let's talk a little bit about where the tax equivalent yields are in high-yield munis as compared with comparable yields on high yield corporates.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I think this is a fantastic opportunity for most investors right now, especially as you said, as people start thinking about their taxes and where the best tax efficient opportunities are. Just for some context, when it comes to where people are positioned today, we've seen almost $1 trillion in flows into parts of the fixed income market, into cash assets in the calendar year 2023. People buying bonds, treasuries, money market accounts, and so on, to try to get some yield, but also to, I think, prepare for the risk of recession. Recession, which, you know, didn't occur and is certainly not our expectation at Bank of America. That means that you have a lot of investors right now who maybe weren't in the fixed income markets or weren't in treasury bonds until very recently, who may find when they pay their taxes this year, there's a pretty significant drag, a big hit from those tax rates. High yield munis in particular and municipal bonds generally are really attractive for those tax efficient, tax advantaged yields. So for example, right now, some of the high yield muni ETFs we like, ticker symbol HYMB or HYD are two examples in our research coverage that have that pay you about 5% and on a tax equivalent basis for a high income earner are yielding, you'd have to buy something yielding 8% to beat those yields on those high-yield muni ETFs. We think that's an attractive opportunity right now.
And if you have to go out into the market and you say you to beat the tax equivalent yield on a muni by going into the taxable marketplace, I would assume that you're taking on a much higher level of credit risk.
That's exactly right. And that's another huge advantage, we think, in this market. The fundamentals in the municipal bond market, state and local governments and other issuers, fundamentals are very strong. And my colleagues across Muni Research have confirmed they call this a golden decade for the municipal market, given the strong fiscal positions that many of these issuers are in since COVID. And to get an equivalent level of yield in the taxable market, you would have to go out into double B or even lower rated debt in the high yield corporate bond market, debt levels that would have much higher default rates in any future economic stress scenario. So our sense of it is that a high yield municipal ETF can give you the equivalent yield to some pretty risky high yield corporate bonds, but with much lower expected stress or risk levels in the case of an economic problem.
More yield, less risk. The one thing, among the few things I know about munis and fixed income is this. The one thing you need to watch if you buy a fixed income ETF or a mutual fund is that it's not merely the yield that you should be paying attention to. It is your total return. And if interest rates go up, your total return, the value of your shares, your fund shares, goes down, correct? So what you make in yield, you might give up in total return in part. Walk me through that, assuming that interest rates are going to come down. Not only would you get this yield benefit, but you would also get the booster shot of higher capital values.
That's right. There's a potential for some capital gains, some price return in the kind of scenario you mentioned. That's not our core case for the reasons why we think these are attractive investments. Mm-hmm. But it's true that investors who have been, as I said at the beginning, positioning for rapid declines in interest rates in a recession or a rapid rate cutting scenario from the Fed have plowed money into treasury bonds, into money market accounts, and other higher yielding cash accounts. And we think that the time is right to move out of those maximum safety types of assets into parts of the real economy where you can get an attractive yield with an attractive level of risk, but not be making this kind of one-way bet on the future path of interest rates. Because what's just as important about these high yield and other muni ETFs is that they're connected to the real economy. You're taking a little bit more credit risk, but in return, you're not making all your fixed income portfolio one giant bet on the future path of interest rates and of inflation. And given how sticky inflation has been, given how uncertain I think the path for interest rates is going to be over the long term, we think that moving out into the real economy in your fixed income portfolio is a really smart thing to do.
Jared Woodward, the case for high yield munis. Thanks very much. Well said. Appreciate it. Jared Woodward.
Thanks.
All right, he's with B of A Securities. Let's take a break now. Coming up, shares of Paramount lower by about 5% today and 20% so far this year as the company considers takeover options. But Netflix shares are up nearly 30% over the same period, and bullish momentum on the street seems to only be picking up. We'll dig into those two next. Welcome back to The Exchange. Paramount shares lower today as a bidding war for its assets is reportedly heating up. The private equity firm Apollo putting in an $11 billion offer for Paramount's Hollywood studio, and the studio alone, not the whole kit and caboodle. This according to The Wall Street Journal. But sources tell David Faber of CNBC that Paramount is not going to sell its studio business separately. This comes as an independent committee of directors previews Skydance Media's January bid to merge with all of Paramount. Different story, though, for Netflix. It's getting a boost over the past week on bullish calls from the likes of Evercore and J.P. Morgan. KeyBank raising its price target by nearly 22%, writing in a note that strong viewership data and subscriber trends will keep pushing shares higher. Joining us now is the analyst behind that call, KeyBank's Justin Patterson. Justin, welcome. Let's talk just very quickly. I know Paramount is not a stock you follow, but I'd like to get your reactions on it, the action in it, as it bears on media consolidation, something that everybody seems to be talking about these days.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Tyler. And again, I defer to Brandon Nispel, my colleague who covers the media stocks, but stepping back, we've been expecting consolidation for a while within the industry. Everybody went into direct-to-consumer offerings like Netflix to try to get that Netflix multiple. And what a lot of companies have found is this is just a very difficult business model to get working. Churn is higher than what you would expect in a cable world. You have to keep pumping out new content, and that's pretty costly. You've seen the damage it's all wrecked on free cash flow profiles across the industry so far. So we continue to feel that streaming players like Netflix are in the pole position, and the rest have to make some difficult choices here.
Yeah, it's a difficult thing. I mean, Apollo apparently offering $11 billion for a company, Paramount, for the studio, and the entire company is only worth in recent trading about $7.7 billion. So that suggests that the cable properties, the CBS part, is actually a drag on the company's value. Let's turn to Netflix while we're at it. What has caused you to raise your price target on it? What do you see in the numbers, the performance of this company that makes you as bullish as you are?
Yeah, it's a great question. It's a couple things in there, Tyler. So first, when we look at just Netflix's viewership data, you're starting to see more hit content coming back again. So quarter to date, there's five shows that have now garnered over 250 million hours viewed thus far. That's a pretty healthy pickup versus what we were seeing in Q4 earlier this year. And that's before you start to have some of the returning hits like Bridgerton, like Squid Game, like Cobra Kai coming back on the platform. So we step back and look at the data and see just the content portfolio ahead. We see a business that supports accelerating revenue growth, accelerating earnings growth, and that should drive equity returns here.
When I think of stocks, I tend to think in terms of the stock that you sort of must have in your portfolio. I would say Apple might be that kind of stock. I might say that Microsoft would be that kind of stock. In the media world, is Netflix that stock?
Yeah, I think it is. When you just step back, look at where consumers are spending their time more, most of the new shows are hitting Netflix at this point. There's always something new coming every week that's happening around the globe. And then when we step back, this is all before Netflix has really ramped up its advertising business. So we think sometime, maybe later this year, Netflix takes another price increase, widens that gap between the ad-free tier and the ad-supported tier, and really just drives that trade-off of, do you want to pay for ads? Okay. Or do you not want to take ads? Okay, you're going to pay a lot more. And if you're a little more price sensitive, great. They'll monetize you exactly the same way with that ad-free, ad-supported tier. So there's a lot of levers for growth here. They're just getting started on advertising, and we think that continues ahead.
Do you expect Netflix to be more aggressive in competing for live event programming or the rights to the NBA, for example? I think of Amazon, I think of Apple TV as maybe being a little more ahead when it comes to sports broadcasting. Am I right on that? And would you expect Netflix to get into that game more aggressively, quickly?
Yeah, I think you're right on that characterization. Amazon, YouTube, Apple TV all had quite a bit of success within there so far. So I'd expect the bigger players to keep writing the checks. Netflix is more toe in the water, if you will. I don't think any of us had WWE on the bingo card entering this year. Yeah. So that was interesting to see. We'll see how many people watch Mike Tyson and Jake Paul punch each other in the face in the June timeframe.
Yeah.
Probably a lot would be best. And then we'll watch how it goes from there.
Justin, thank you very much. Appreciate your time today. Justin Patterson, thank you.
Thank you.
All right, that does it for The Exchange. Contessa Brewer getting ready across the way. I'll join her for Power Lunch in a moment on the other side of this quick break. See you then.
You've been listening to The Exchange. Make sure you're subscribed to get each episode every day, same time, same place.
Sometimes it takes a different approach to help you unlock your true potential. With Capella University's game-changing FlexPath learning format, you gain relevant skills you can apply to your career right away. Earn your degree from an accredited university and be confident in the quality of your education. Imagine your future differently at capella.edu. Capella University is accredited by the Higher Learning Commission. Learn more at capella.edu/accreditation.